This week on the line, we catch up with our friend Mark Murphy.
We're not going to have enough time to hear all his stories. Welcome, Mark Murphy.
All right, thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
On the Line. That's our podcast.
On the Line.
Yeah.
We're cooking together.
Here we go.
Pretty much. Thank you. Seriously, thank you for being here. The famous, the infamous.
I prepared a little something for you. I'm going to read so you can get all the nonsense behind us and really talk about juicy stuff.
Dan is going to introduce you to our listeners if there's anybody who doesn't know who you are.
We are joined today by Chef Mark Murphy. How's that?
That was great.
For an intro.
Perfect.
Mark grew up moving from city to city through Europe's most celebrated culinary countries and the United States. He attended the Institute of Culinary Education without a great deal of intention, but quickly realized his passion for food and the culinary arts during his apprenticeship in one of Europe's finest Michelin-starred kitchens. Mark's resume as a cook is as long and storied as his list of restaurants he's opened and run. He's a celebrated chef and restaurateur, an avid culinary educator. He's a television star, best-selling author, a loyal husband, a celebrated podcast host, and perhaps most importantly, he's helping shape the future of food policy in America through his work with the New York State Restaurant Association, the U.S. State Department's Diplomatic Culinary Partnership Program, and a veritable smorgasbord of charitable organization. He's tall, he's handsome, and he's got a full head of hair. Plus, he absolutely tears it up on the dance floor.
Yes, he does.
Please welcome a man I've envied and emulated, and I will never reach his stature. I will never be as tall as you, Mark Murphy. Chef Mark Murphy.
That was a lot.
It's all true is the worst part about it.
It's not. I feel like I haven't done anything yet, though.
I think your title should be The Surprising Mark Murphy. There are so many things that people don't know about you.
We should keep it that way sometimes.
The fact that you grew up as the son of a diplomat, the fact that you traveled, that you're not truly American, that you speak multiple languages, that...
How many languages do you speak?
I mean, I grew up speaking French and Italian and English, so those were just there. And then I guess working in New York City kitchens, you learn how to speak Spanish, as we call it, kitchen Spanish, I would say.
Kitchen Spanish, yes.
So, yes, I can go to Oaxaca and,
order a taco.
Work my way through it. It's fine.
The first time I went to Spain and I was speaking Spanish and this lady just started laughing out loud and I was like, what are you? And she goes, you sound like a uneducated, like 15-year-old kid from like the gutter of Puerto Rico. And I was like, what? And she was like, your Spanish is so terrible. I was like,
when I go to actual Spain, they don't understand you. It's a different language, really.
Different language.
A different dialect. But here we are in New York City, which is where all of us have met. That's how I met you. I met you when you were the chef at a restaurant called La Fourchette.
The spoon.
The fork.
That was a long time ago.
That was a very long time ago. I remember when it was chefs doing these charitable events, walk around tastings. You had a table and your display was all lemons. I'll never forget that.
Oh, I did. I got those glass bricks.
Yep.
I remember this as well. I put glass bricks down and then I got a piece of clear plexiglass and I filled the whole thing underneath with lemons. And I thought that was a fun little decor.
It was.
I love it.
And obviously memorable now that Amanda still remembers it.
And you remember it as well. That was a moment in time.
It was a moment in time. And we still do these crazy festivals together. We were just at Mohegan Sun. Mm-hmm. We're on our way to South Beach Food and Wine Festival in a couple of weeks. And of course, we are fellow judges on Chopped. We do compete against each other sometimes.
I let her win.
Every time he lets me win. How weird is that?
Unbelievable.
I just don't want to have to hear it.
I get it.
I'm a good sport, man. We compete on Tournament of Champions, beat Bobby Flay, Chopped. But mostly I like to just cook with you and take road trips.
Road trips are fun.
We've taken purposeful road trips and accidental road trips together.
Yes. The last accidental one was coming down where we were in Rochester, New York. We had to rent a car and drive back to New York City in the middle of the night because the airplanes weren't flying. We were just coming back from doing a gig in a casino in Canada.
Yep. Wow. And nothing was flying. So we got in a car and we drove.
Amanda did the playlist. I did the driving. We listened to, most of the way, songs that you'd want to listen to while driving a car or something like that. There was
it's actually called Yacht Rock, but whatever.
No, there was another one.
Oh, there's another playlist. That's true.
Well, yeah, and Yacht
Road trip songs. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love being the DJ. Mark's a good driver. He loves to drive. But there is one thing besides the other million things that you don't know about Mark Murphy. He doesn't like snacks in the car.
What?
He doesn't like to eat in the car.
Is that because it's your car and you're like precious about the leather?
Mark is a fork and knife, sit at a table, that's where you eat your meal kind of guy.
That's your European upbringing coming through.
I like to have a napkin in my lap while I'm eating.
I love that.
I mean, it doesn't have to be a cloth napkin. It can be, you know, a paper napkin sitting down having a lobster roll somewhere or something and a beer. You know, I'm just talking, you know, it's got to be a... I feel like, look, eating is something obviously is very ingrained in me. I want to eat. I love eating. I love food. It's my whole life. But also, it's not just about the food. It's about the company. It's about being around a table, enjoying a good time, enjoying conversation. And you know what? If you're just eating while you're walking down the street, you're not doing any of that. You're just
feeding yourself. If you loved season with intention, it's eat with integrity. No. If you loved season with, what was your cookbook
authority.
Called? Authority.
Season with authority.
It's eat with intention.
Eat with intention.
That's your second cookbook.
Second cookbook.
But here's the, well, maybe. I don't know. I've got to get around to that. I'm very lazy.
Like you've never been to McDonald's? You don't just like stop at the drive-thru? No, you've never been to McDonald's.
I mean, I've been there, but it's like mostly out of sheer necessity because I'm driving somewhere in the country where there's nothing else to eat.
You're not like a McNugget man no matter what.
No, I'd rather stay away from things like that. I mean, look, I try to be healthy. I mean, it's not just because I just want it. I want to be healthy, but I also want to eat good food. Yeah. I don't want to waste a meal on shitty
not
food.
A one waste. That's like my dream.
I never want to waste
a meal again.
Nutrient dense food.
I'm not here that long. Yeah. I want to enjoy every meal.
Well, you've got that. It's like, don't take it for granted. We're so lucky. We have this every opportunity. And it's like, why would I waste a meal?
But that's the great thing about living in New York City, right? It's like New York City, we have so much at our disposal. So many great places to eat. I mean, I was walking downtown and I was hungry. And there was Eataly, and I was like, oh, I have to look at my emails. I went inside the fish restaurant there. I had a beautiful piece of cod on top of some roasted squash with a little bit of, a little olive oil.
This effing guy over here.
We had donuts and potato chips.
I ate some, like...
I mean, to me, it's like I was by myself, but I have to eat something, and I want to eat something that's good. I don't want to waste my...
I just stopped by Danielle, had a little caviar. It's Tuesday.
That's not unlike Mark at all. And the thing that I love... when we travel together, whether it be for work or for travel inspiration or for culinary diplomacy, is Mark will always stop us and say, okay, where are we having lunch? Let's figure it out. Where are we having dinner? We're going to take that moment.
Where was the last good lunch we had in San Francisco?
Oh,
we went
place?
To a great restaurant.
Well, I'm the researcher. I find the spots.
I don't do that.
What restaurant you go to San Francisco? I thought San Francisco was like you just only eat in a tent on the street or something.
No.
Like,
no. Are
there restaurants?
Not at all.
No, we found this Greek place. It was phenomenal. Sardines were so good.
I wish I could remember the name of it, but it was perfect.
Have you been to Kokari in San Francisco? That's
simple.
One of my favorite restaurants in the country.
What?
Kokari? K-O-K. No,
it's
a big restaurant.
Kokari's it's a big restaurant.
Yeah, Kokari. It's Greek. One of my favorite restaurants
in
America.
That's the restaurant.
Maybe that's
it's an extraordinary Greek restaurant downtown San Francisco.
It's got old school chairs.
Oh, yeah. And,
big...
they always have something going on the rotisserie.
Yes.
When
you first walk in. That is top 10 in America.
That's where we were.
I found it.
Spectacular restaurant.
That's where we were. So I thank you for making me stop and smell the roses and drink the wine and have beautiful lunches. Thank you, Mark.
Stop and smell the spanakopita.
Yes, I do. I do.
And we all should.
We all should. Okay, so there's so much more to talk about. We can talk about your upbringing, how you're a bad boy in school, and then you found your way into kitchens. We can talk about that.
I'm like deeply interested in your charitable work and the fact that you're legitimately helping to shape the way that the food in America is taught to our kids, and I think that's a piece of the puzzle.
I think as a chef, we should have integrity, and we should have integrity about our craft, and also how we educate other people about our craft. And I think that as a chef, you can make food that might not be healthy all the time because it's like, you know, it's a an indulgence of some sort. But, you know, we need to take ingredients. We need to whip them up into things that are good, healthy, tasty. We go for flavor, but we also have to, like, I think that's the great thing about being on Chopped is Chopped is one of these places that every basket has four ingredients in it. We might not all know about it. Our viewers might not know about those ingredients, but we have the opportunity to talk about those ingredients and to talk about them in their different forms and how they're going to be able to be manipulated and cooked at home. Like, somebody might, if they've lived in the middle of the country, have never cooked an artichoke, and all of a sudden they see artichokes on Chopped and they hear us talk about that. I think it's a great thing.
So it's not just educational. People are, like, inspired and feel confident to try something new, and even if you screw up, it's okay.
Well, absolutely. I think that's the great thing about Chopped is it's a game show that by you happen to, and you turns out we're educating people at the same time, but they don't know it sometimes. It's sort of a trick. Yes. We're tricking them into learning things. And I'm not talking about all the ingredients, because like the other day we had these we had something like a sour belt, they called it. It was some type of candy, which I thought was revolting.
Oh my wait, god, sour belt wait, and cod? That oh, wasn't at Eataly?
Wait a minute. This is the thing I love about you, Mark, is you know what a sour belt is. I know what a sour belt is. Mark doesn't know a lot about American culture.
Oh no, this man is pop he culture, is he's television. Pretending.
No, he really doesn't. Well, you never had there's some candies that you've never experienced before. No. There's candy bars, like things that are so American pop culture, you're just finding out about them.
I am, and sometimes I'm horrified by them. I'm like, this is yes. what the children are eating? Why? I mean, look, I work with Share Our Strength, No Kid Hungry. We're trying to get, you know, kids not to be hungry in this country and to eat healthy, and we're getting breakfast in the classrooms because children who are in come to school who are maybe don't have as much as other people don't eat at home because there's not enough money and they don't have enough food. So sometimes some kids in our country only eat at school, right?
And there's like that direct correlation between I ate something and then I succeeded. I'm hungry. I didn't pay attention and I absolutely. Failed. And it's like,
but yeah. on top of that, what's really great about Billy Shore, who started this organization, who have really been concentrating on this is, you know, most of the time our federal dollars are there to help feed these children in schools. But there's a stigma on getting to school early and going to the cafeteria. It's like, oh, you're the poor kid who right. doesn't have food at home. You have to come in early and eat breakfast in the cafeteria. So by moving breakfast into the classrooms on these little carts and getting teachers to buy into this, and teachers at first, I think, were probably like, oh, now I'm going to have a messy classroom. I have to have apples and bananas and yogurt and applesauce and things like that and milk cartons in my classroom.
Do you have kids?
What's that? I have two kids. Yeah.
So you know how hard it is to get just like a kid to eat.
Yeah, but basically what these teachers found out, it's like, wow, if we take 10, 15 minutes out of our day in the beginning of the day and feed them something, they'll actually sit in their classroom chairs and they'll sit here and learn. Because no child is going to learn if they're hungry. They're going to think about
that. They could do that in the courtroom, by the way. We could fix this recidivism thing in the jails as well, by the way.
We could do that.
They got the judges eating.
Well, but listen, we're talking about being a kid and eating at school. Your upbringing was very different. How did you fall into culinary or find your way into culinary?
I have to say that when people ask me how I got into the culinary field, is basically I think I credit it to my dyslexia. I'm very dyslexic.
What does that mean?
They used to call it a learning disability, and it's basically we learn differently than most people. We don't go like the flow. Most people learn in school the same way, and they have a way of learning. We learn differently. We look at things in a different way. We have a special ability to not see things one way. We kind of go around the road and kind of go different directions to get to the same end of the same problem.
That sounds like an advantage.
It's turning out that everybody is realizing that most people that are dyslexic are extremely successful. And there was an article I read recently that they don't think humanity would have made it without dyslexics, because we are able to solve problems in a different way and really can go around and see things from a totally different angle. And I'm working with an organization called Made by Dyslexia. It's out of England, and we're really trying to educate the whole world, all teachers, to sort of recognize what dyslexia is, because a lot of people see a dyslexic kid in class and go, this kid's just stupid, which is what happened to me. I was always I was the dumb kid in class, and I became the class clown because it was the only way I could get attention besides getting in trouble. And it turns out most people that are dyslexic are probably a lot smarter than everybody else. So now I feel bad for everybody, but that's fine.
You're a pure entertainment. But here's the deal.
But what was crazy about it was that if they had actually learned how to teach me earlier, I did not go to college. I went to the college counselor when I finally got to that point, and they looked and laughed at me and said, you better go get a job. There's no college that will accept you with your grades.
What was your first job?
I moved to New York City. I crashed on my brother's couch, and I became basically my his girlfriend was a born and raised New Yorker, and it was around the time when her friends were all having babies and getting married and stuff like that. So I was basically a handyman for all her friends, and they were paying me. I was building closets, stenciling baby
I
rooms.
I feel like I saw this movie.
How handy like, were you?
You were doing all the plumbing with the
whatever it took. My father, my grandfather was an engineer for Schlumberger, which was an oil company. He worked in the fields in South America during the war, and he was always a very handy guy. And when I used to spend my summers as a little kid in the south of France, that's where we would go for our vacations. A little town called Lourdes up in above Villefranche and above Nice and Grasse. And I was the little kid. I would follow him around all the time. They would buy me like these little pants with a thing to hang the hammer off of. And I would do. And literally, I grew up in the summer times just helping him out as much as I could. And my brother was the smart guy, and he would sit in a corner and read a book and do things like that. And I was always running around. So when I moved to New York, I was like, I basically became a handyman. And after a while, I would cook dinner for my brother and his girlfriend all the time because I felt bad. I was crashing on the couch. I wasn't paying rent. And after a while, my brother kind of said, "You seem to like to cook. Why don't you go to cooking school?" And I thought, is that a thing? Like, I had no idea.
Yeah, it's not a thing.
And you said I went to ICE. It turns out I did, but it was back then. It was called Peter Kump's New York Cooking School.
Yeah.
It was a 3-month cooking school. It was, I think it was $4,000. Catherine Alpert was my teacher, who later on I ended up rerunning into her. She was the head of the Food Network kitchen, which was really funny.
Wow.
I was like, and she had been watching me on TV going, "Oh, there's Mark." And she had never contacted me. Said,
"Star student."
It was so funny. And all of a sudden I walked in the kitchen one day. She's like, "Hey," I was like, "What are you doing here?" She goes, "What are you doing here? I've been watching you the whole time." That was a whole funny thing. And I just fell in love with cooking because it was the first time I could do something that anybody said I did anything good at. I was never good at anything. I had zero confidence. I literally thought if I start cooking, I could deal with being homeless because I'm pretty handy. I probably build a really nice refrigerator box to live in, but I did not want to be hungry. Yeah. I knew growing up and eating really good food as a kid and going, you know, living in France and Italy and all that stuff, I ate good food. So I was like really worried about being hungry. So I thought, well, if I learn how to cook, at least I'll be able to eat. So that was one of the reasons I got into it.
Smart. But what about dancing? I heard you assisted a choreographer in the 90s as a job. Is this true?
Yeah. My roommates, after I went to cooking school, I ended up crashing on another couch with my roommates in the East Village.
By the way, he's still crashing on couches. If anybody in the audience has an available
couch.
By the way, I would much rather go to somebody's house and sleep on their couch than go to a hotel because I find it more, much more interesting.
You get to cook in their kitchen.
You get to be more within the fabric of wherever you are, right?
Yes.
I just ended up, when I worked with Jerry Robbins, I was in between jobs and my roommates were really good friends with him and he became a friend of mine as well. He was sort of my New York City grandfather. I would end up having dinner with him and we would talk about life and he would give me advice about things and he was an amazing choreographer. And oddly enough, when I met him the first time, I was introduced to him and I said, and my brother actually introduced me to him when he says, "And this is Jerry Robbins, the choreographer of West Side Story." And West Side Story was my favorite movie. And I literally, at that point in my life, I didn't even know what choreographer meant.
Right.
And finally I was like, "Oh, this is great." And afterwards I asked my brother, "What's a choreographer?" And he goes, "He's the guy who does all the dance. He choreographed all the dance." I'm like, "Oh my gosh, that was amazing." Yeah. So it was,
So you ended up working for him.
I did. It was a really weird thing. He was doing this Jerome Robbins retrospective at the New York City Ballet. He was doing, I think, 54 of his ballets for one season, and he had to rehearse all of them. And right before it happened, he was riding his bike in the park and fell down and got a concussion. And so he was fine, but the doctors were like, "You can't be by yourself." I think he was in his early 70s at the time. And he was like, "We need you to be, somebody's got to be with you. We're worried because it's going to be a lot of work and whatnot." So he called me up and he goes, "Listen, I feel really embarrassed, but I basically need a walker to hang out with me because they're worried the doctors. So listen, I know you're in between jobs. Why don't you come here? I'll pay you to hang out with me. So for me, I would get up in the morning in the East Village, take the subway up. He lived on 81st Street on the East Side. We would take a car service, go to the New York City Ballet. We rehearse all day, have lunch, bring him home, have dinner, and then I would go home and do it over again. So I got to spend
like rent-a-friend.
Almost, I almost got to spend 3 months with probably one of the most genius choreographers in the world at the time, and watch him rehearse all of his ballets and bringing some of them back out from the things he hadn't done in a long time. And watching this man work, his art, was probably one of the most privileged moments of my life. I sort of knew it at the time, but I didn't. Later on, you really see this. But I still go to the ballet. I'm a huge ballet fan.
So is this
I was there last week.
Your love of ballet came from?
It was partially. I already liked the ballet before that. And I well,
you're
it was
such an interesting man. It's and like you're the most interesting man in the world. I like the ballet.
You know, and by the
this
way,
is what I'm saying. So that's the surprising Mark Murphy. Things you will never know. He goes to you should go to the ballet with this guy. He knows everybody in the room.
But
it's fascinating.
There was another. You know, I was a young straight man in New York, and going to the ballet was kind of nice because you could, you know, you end up meeting some of the dancers and stuff. And I, you know, I was attracted to them. Maybe
single, and now you're still a young straight man in New York.
I feel like the restaurant.
Well, and I was single, you know, hanging out at the ballet with all these cute ballerinas.
Running a restaurant is like the ballet.
They're flexible.
It has a lot. There's a lot in common. No. Between the restaurant and
yes,
the galley,
and
I mean,
it's
your
interesting
because
one of my
choreography of a dining room. And
one of my very good friends, who Benjamin Millepied, who's was a principal dancer at City Ballet, and he is French, and we were very good friends. And he ended up, when he would get injured at City Ballet, he sometimes used to come to Windows on the World when I was a chef up there and cook with us. And
you
he
were
was,
the chef at Windows on the World.
I was the chef at Cellar in the Sky on top of the World Trade Center before Michael LaMonaco took over and before the World Trade Center fell down. Right,
before clearly
9/11.
Before it was 9/11.
But I, and it was very funny because he was like, man, you guys are crazy. Because he would see the way we would work and the way we would party. And, you know, I was 27, 28 years old at the time. And it was fun. And we used to cook and it was awesome, whatever. But it was funny because he was just staying with me and his two kids a couple weeks ago. He came by for a week. And we were talking about his craft and art and the cooking. And it's interesting because all of the language in our crafts are French, right? Mm-hmm. Pas de bourrée and all these different like dancing terms. And we have it in French, you know, a lot of French terms
in the kitchen,
right?
Yes.
So there is a lot of correlation to that. Not only that, I think we have also the ballet and the food and, you know, running a kitchen is like a ballet, as you just said. If something falls apart, if the garde-manger goes down, the whole show's screwed, right? You have to pick up the pieces. Same thing in a ballet. If something's going wrong, you know, have to make it work. Everybody's got to support each other.
The thing that I keep on always coming back to is, like, you go to a restaurant and you think it happens right then and there. It's just like you would never go to the ballet and just assume that all those characters got on stage and did that in the moment.
Without practicing.
But, like, everything that goes into a great – and I feel like for home cooks, you know – that's they forget and mistake and misunderstand that. It's like the quality of your meal happened way before you started cooking. It was when you started thinking about what to cook with the resources and skills you had.
Or what to order.
You know. Oh, yeah. Depends on the restaurant and depends on how busy they are, what you're doing. And there's so many. It always kills me when everybody goes out to eat and it's like they complain about something. Do you know what it took to get this food on the table?
Me and my chef friends, when we go out to eat, we got like a little thing. We look at each other and it says, you know that we don't think this restaurant is going to be great if we're arguing over who gets the burger and who gets the chicken. You know? It's like, what do you want? I get the burger.
I'm going to have the steak rare and the Caesar salad. That's all that looks safe on this menu. It's
well,
definitely true.
So you've been a conductor in many restaurants around New York City. Most people would know you from Landmark because you had multiple locations, obviously in Tribeca.
Semi-eponymous Landmark restaurant. Yeah. By Mark Murphy.
I mean, it just for me, I had so many great memories of eating in Landmark. And then uptown in Columbus Circle, you had Landmark. You've had restaurants all over. You had Ditch Plains.
I had two Ditch Plains.
Ditch
I had
Plains
Landmark. And I also had a place called Kingside for a little while in the Viceroy Hotel on 57th Street.
I remember that as well. So you ran restaurants. You've done front of the house ever?
Not really.
You're
you don't
so
want
charming.
Me. You don't want me out there.
You know so much about wine.
You don't want me out there.
Okay. And now, now in this era of being a celebrity chef, being a ballet lover.
Being a ballerina and a celebrity chef. What's next?
What's come out of this podcast? Mark's a dancing ballerina. What's going on here?
You still have a restaurant space here in New York City in Tribeca, which is an event space, which I love. And I've done many events there. Tell me about it. Tell me what it means to you. Tell me what it is, what it does, what's its function.
All right. So I have this place in Tribeca. We call it MM Kitchen Studio. Because that's what it looks good on an Instagram, I guess. I don't know what was the idea there.
I think it was your initials, no?
Well, no, I don't know.
Or the little candies or something.
It's anyway, we do private events. Yes, people can book the place for private events. We book it out. Some people want to come film movies there, or if somebody wants to come and shoot TikToks there, they can rent it out. You can do whatever you want. But I don't want to get back into the restaurant business in New York. It's very difficult. It's very demanding, and it's, you know, honestly, this city does not make it easy for small businesses to succeed. And that's something that I have a big gripe with, because I feel like there's a lot to our city that restaurants give so much to our neighborhoods, so much to our culture, and so much to the heartbeat of the city.
That I'm trying to pay taxes over here. Like,
right, it's
help me
open. I
agree
with you. Do you want to compare that to Paris? And do you want to tell us a little bit?
I don't really know the economics of running a restaurant in Paris, so I don't think I can do that. All I know is that every time you turn around in New York City, it's a fine for this, it's a this for that. There's nobody helping you open a restaurant. In contrast to somebody who ran restaurants in New York, told me once they went to North Carolina to open a restaurant. They have some restaurants down there now. When they were building the restaurant, somebody from the city came in and said, hey, we're from the city. And of course, this guy from New York was like, oh shit, what's happened? What do I do? What's the fine going to be? And the person from North Carolina walked in and said, hi, I'm from the city. I was just wondering, we're so happy you're here to open a restaurant. You're going to be great. It's going to be great for the neighborhood
part
of the community. And is there anything we can do to help? And literally the guy's like, am I on candid camera? Because this does not happen in New York.
It's so
right?
true.
And it's sad that that's the case here. There's way too much sandpaper in between small business and our city government.
Also,
and
just
our state
stifles
government.
Like the barrier to entry is so high that it stifles creativity.
Exactly.
And you know, you find other cities, tertiary markets are driving all the creativity in the culinary world. And what it's really sad.
I always say that Wiley Dufresne doesn't still have his restaurant down in the Lower East Side, where he was doing amazingly creative food with a great chef and a great creator like he is, that it does not exist anymore in New York City is extremely, it's sad, and it's just not
it's a
good
to the
thing
detriment
for our city.
of the city, yeah. And the fact that New York City is a melting pot and it's a cultural center of the world, but it's only a cultural center of the world if it's not all chain restaurants.
It's got to be nourished. And by the way, we also, you know, that we have a lot of immigrant conversations going on. The restaurant industry is the first port of entry for any immigrant that comes into our city, either being selling hot dogs on the street or a busboy or a dishwasher or a line cook that can work their way up to become a sous chef and a chef and be an entrepreneur themselves. We are the lifeline for them. And it's not, there's not enough, kudos given to the pain, suffering, and investments that people put into restaurants in this city. I mean, they say one out of five restaurants in the city doesn't make it past a year. That's a lot of wasted money that people don't need to go through the troubles and toils of doing that. But on that note, I do want to stay in the restaurant industry a little bit in New York. So what I'm doing is, I think it's next month. I can't remember exactly the dates. I'll tell you later.
Okay.
You'll see it on my Instagram.
I'll look there.
But I'm going to be opening up the restaurant again under a new name, and it's going to be open 3 days a month. And it's going to be a prefix menu, four courses. I'm going to do the same type of wine program I used to do at Landmark, which is a very inexpensive markup on the wines. Four communal tables in the space. Make a reservation, 5:30 to probably 11 o'clock at night. It's going to be a four-course tasting menu.
And you're going to be there.
And I'm going to be there.
We got the exclusive here on the line.
It's going to be like, it's going to be sort of like Mark in residency, 3 days a month. For the public, cooking in Tribeca. I'm super excited about it. I think it's going to be...
That's going to be a hard reservation to get. 3 days a month only.
Yeah.
The best part about it is like...
Of course, you know who's been killing me. I told this to Jonathan Waxman, and he looked at me just... he as only Jonathan can be like, oh, you're going to work 3 days a month? Good. Good for you. I'm glad about that.
Jonathan was the one who looked me in the eye about 8 months ago and said, don't you dare go back into the restaurant business. So
I gotta say,
we will be talking to
him
soon.
I love the restaurant business, and I'm extremely thankful. And I spend my time in my restaurant. It's given me so much in my life. It's a very contrarian opinion amongst restaurateur folks, because I think I could not have done anything and been successful other than own restaurants in my life, and no other business would have given me so much. So many chances.
Right. You'd probably be in jail if it wasn't for that.
Well, I also love...
Pretty much on my way.
Mark, to me, you're in the business of cooking and hosting and creating a memory. I really feel like that, to you, is the most important thing. One of your favorite things to do is get all your friends together at a table. In the summertime, you just love having people over and cooking whatever is available. Like, you're such an artist that way, where you just take what's given... Take what's seasonal and you cook for 20 people, 15 people. You love that kind of communal eating. Is that what you're trying to do now in the Landmark space and Mark Murphy Studios?
It's pretty much it, because I feel as though it's just great to gather people. Most of the rewarding thing about having a restaurant is, one, employing people and knowing that they're making a living and they're supporting their families or spouses or relatives, right? That's a great thing. The other thing is getting people together and having a good time and being part of that, right? Four people sitting at a table having a great memory. People, while I walk around the city, the people that still stop me today, thank you, Mark. I had my daughter's graduation dinner at Landmark Time Warner, and we still remember it. It was one. So now I was part of that, and I love to do that. So this is why I want to sort of dip my toe into it a little bit and do it again. And I think that this is a big problem with chefs, that growing up in the kitchen and working at Ducasse and Monte Carlo, one-star Michelin in Paris and Le Cirque, and everybody's like food, 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 right? When you become a restaurateur and you become a chef owner, you realize very quickly, at least I did, it's not just about the food, right? True. You can make the best food possible. If the temperature of the room is wrong, if the lighting's wrong, if the music's wrong, if the chair's uncomfortable and the table setting's bad, it doesn't matter how good the food is, they're not coming back. It's equal parts everything. You have to have you have to have good food, you have to have a good ambiance, you have to have good lighting, you have to have good music. You have to have all of those things happen at once. If you can do that,
magic.
You're really creating a place for people to dine and have a good time. The only thing you can't control is who they're eating with. Because if you're eating dinner with your future ex-wife or ex-husband, there's not a thing in the world I can do as a restaurateur to fix that one. They probably are not going to come back to your restaurant no matter what, how good it was.
Well, sometimes you can change a mood. Sometimes you can change the vibe.
But it's so true. And I always used to say this when my management staff, it was something that I always drilled into them. I did not want, I think the other experience is the wait staff, the people that are waiting on you, the people that are serving you the food, that are taking your orders. They have to be people that are nice. I always said to my staff, don't hire people that have a lot of skill and that have a lot of background in working in New York City restaurants, because they're jaded and they're probably, I said, hire nice people. I can hire a nice person and teach them how to wait tables. I cannot take somebody who knows how to wait tables and teach them how to be nice. I haven't figured that out. So take nice people and teach them how to, because when you go to a restaurant, that's also part of the experience. What was your interaction like with the waiter? And I always used to tell my staff, like, you should know when they want you and when they don't want you. It's like a really good bartender, right? A really good bartender knows when to engage with somebody and when not to engage with people in a conversation. And that's what kills me. I went to a restaurant recently. They spent $5 million building it. The reason I know this is because I was talking to the bartender. And the bartender said, yeah, they gave me a chance here. They spent so much money building this restaurant. I said, what do you mean they gave you a chance? He goes, oh, I was the painter and they're letting me be the bartender. I was like, what?
Just overshare.
So, but basically, you think about this, right?
I love that.
You just hired a painter, right? You should hire a person who knows how to bartend.
You spend $5 million on your rent.
It's one of those things, like, you be nice, hire the bartender, but you have to teach this painter how to be a bartender. He had no idea how to be a bartender.
Okay,
he was so awkward with every customer that came in. I was like, you just spent all this money and you didn't take the time to make sure that piece of the puzzle, which is a huge piece of the friction between the customer and the actual business, right? Which is your interaction with them. Make sure they know what they're doing. So you need to, as I said, hire nice people and train them to how to be nice and how to do the job too. You know, you can't just.
Was he a nice painter?
I mean, he was nice enough, but he had no idea how to.
Straightest lines in the business, I got to tell you. He knew white from gray. This guy.
Okay, so we're gonna come. We're gonna come to one of these nights. What is the menu is gonna be different every night?
No, it's gonna be a 3-day pop up with the same menu for 3 nights.
Okay,
so and then the next month it'll be totally different.
Each month.
So come on the third night, because by the third night
we'll finally get it right. Well, that's my big scare. I'm like, wait, are we gonna be able to open a restaurant for 3 days and get it right?
And actually get it right.
But I think if we're just serving 4 dishes, we could do this. And by the way, I want to keep this not too expensive as well. It's probably going to be like $75 a head. I want to make sure that we're using local, you know, fresh ingredients from the time and make it. I don't want to make it, but I could swear to you this. Okay. We will not have any foam on the menu, and we will not have be using any tweezers.
Ooh.
No foam, no tweezers.
I love that. Well, I got 2 sizes. It's Rough Chop and RoboCoop. Those are one or the other, right? I got to ask you, you know, it's so few people have had a chance to really get intimately to know these like iconic culinary countries. Wow, really killing it with my alliteration today. I travel to France, I travel to Italy, and I eat. And sometimes I find myself kind of like disappointed because the dream that I had of what it was supposed to be, it doesn't match up to the reality of what I'm experiencing. And is there some kind of like, is there something I'm doing wrong as a traveler? How do you find your way through these countries and pick at, are you planning ahead of time when you're traveling and eating? Or?
I'm lucky enough that my wife is a travel advisor and she's really good at that. And whenever I travel with other people, I usually put it on them to find the places.
I can,
like Amanda here.
I can attest to that.
but I think that, you go back to my conversation about what makes a great restaurant, all those other parts, right? The people, the air, where you are. And I think that's what you when you go to a country, like if you're going to, you know, let's say you're going to, I don't know, to the south of Italy, right? And you're thinking about, well, you're overlooking the ocean and you're having this and you're doing that. Is that food much better than where you are otherwise? Yeah, the ingredients are probably better. They might be prepared really well. But it's in the end, it's food, right? I mean, if you move that food somewhere else, it would be probably just as good. But you have to, it's time and setting, right?
So all the time I go to restaurants, people are like, you're a restaurant guy. What's wrong with me? I'm like, why would you want me to ruin it for you? And don't make me ruin it for myself by picking this thing apart. I'm having like a glass of wine and a steak. It's delicious.
It's prepared. People always tell me, oh, Mark, you travel so much. You should do a travel show. And I think to myself, let's see. If I'm at Lo Scoglio down on the Amalfi Coast, sitting there eating the beautiful fresh shrimp that the fisherman just pulled up on the dock and threw him in the fryer and put a little salt on him and put him
so
at the table,
hungry.
And I'm having a beautiful, nice white wine from a local producer, you know what? How I could ruin that meal?
By telling everybody about it.
Yeah, by having a microphone on me and 2 camera people and a producer and extended. And it's like, you know what? Now I'm not having fun anymore. But that's what I mean by time and setting. It's like, that to me is like perfect. Could you take those shrimp and fly them 6,000 miles away and fry them the exact same way? Probably. But you're not sitting on the Amalfi Coast with the sun kissing your face and, you know, the sand in your toes and the salt water that's just the salt that's dried on you since you got, after you got out of the boat that you're, you know, a little itchy and it feels great. Oh, you know what I mean?
This is romantic.
Do you think that this is the cell phone? Like, I'm wondering that. Like, I know my wife, every time I pull out my phone to take a picture of the food, she just looks at me like, we're not together. We're not connected. We're not enjoying the food. If why are you, you know, who are you doing this for? You're here for us. Like,
it's for me, it's a memory to take a photo. But I go back to what you were saying. There's a joy of discovery, right? There's a joy of walking down that street in Rome and finding that restaurant and enjoying it. There's a joy of finding a bad restaurant. If you go somewhere and you're like, wow, this was terrible, you still have a good time. Honestly, I still have a good time if it's bad, almost more so because you got to laugh at it, you know? Mm. But, you know, I say the Rome example because you were in Rome and I was there a couple months after you and I went to this restaurant that you recommended for lunch. I was
Which
the only
spot?
Person in the room for a minute. I can't remember the name of it.
God, I will.
Where were you? Da Pompieri?
Yes.
Da Pompieri. Terribly lit restaurant. Yeah.
Terribly lit.
But beautiful fried brains and fried
Is it like jokes. Brightly? That's like my favorite thing about Italy. You go to this like romantic setting and they got the neon light.
Yeah, I know.
What's going on
they
with fluorescence?
Yeah, they don't get the ambient lighting. No. But I did go during the day and I sat in front of an open window with the sun shining through. And it was probably one of the best meals I had the whole time I was there. And I was the only person in the room for about an hour. And it was perfection. And I would have never found that place if it wasn't for you. You probably walk down that street. You found it yourself. I'm glad you told me about it. I can share it with a few people, but like you said, why share that with cameras? And
I don't know. That's hospitality world is all about sharing and caring, and you know.
I think the whole
you're bringing in a crew. You're kind of ruining the experience. You'd have to. I don't know. Anyway, so the joy of discovery, I think, is something that you revel in as well.
I by the way, I think that it's so funny, guys. I do love the unknown.
Right.
Like going to a new city and just walking around and meeting people, and all of a sudden somebody drags you somewhere you just met. People are like, why would you do that? I'm like, why not? Who knows where it's going to end up? I flew from San Francisco to New York, changed my suitcase, flew to Rome, and went to Palermo. I was doing a gig in Sicily. I got to Palermo. Like, this is something, and I was by myself. I was meeting two other people there 2 days later. I get to Palermo. I get an Airbnb. I show up. This woman shows up in front of the building drunk, grabs my hand and says, here, this is your room. We go upstairs. She barges in the front door, unlocks the door, I got to pee. She goes to use the bathroom. This is my Airbnb, right? Most people would be like, this is crazy. I'm going to a hotel, whatever, right? I'm like, let's see what happens. She comes out of the bathroom. She goes, let's go. You're coming with us. I go, where are we going? She goes, it's Gay Pride in Palermo. It's a party. So she grabs my hand. We run out in the street. The next thing I know, I have a beer in my hand. Maybe a joint in the other.
Maybe.
We're walking down the street. There's this parade going on. I was out till 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm in the middle of the street. There's people dancing. There's street meat being cooked. There's like, you know, there's all this amazing food, like people eating on the streets and dancing. Everywhere. I lost those people an hour later. But I ended up.
I found new people.
I had so much a good time at around 3 a.m. I go, I wonder where that apartment is.
where you're supposed to be staying.
Where I'm supposed to be going to sleep at some point. But I had no idea what I was going to get into. It was a blast.
Yeah. I mean, the unplanned.
Go for it. Yes.
Yes. The spontaneity.
That's like the one thing. One advice for traveling overseas is plan less and leave opportunity for discovery, because the best things happen unexpectedly. And fewer folks, like by yourself. The world opens up to you when you're by yourself. It's spectacular.
You're a bon vivant.
Exactly. I was diagnosed with that by my therapist.
A rebel, a gypsy.
The joie de vivre is strong with this one.
Exactly.
And a really incredible father. And so I know how proud you are of your children. And I know that you're probably not a real sporty guy, but now you're very much into basketball because of your son.
Exactly.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
So this is on camera, so you want to see me cry talking about my kids?
I know, I'm sorry. and I are the only people who ever cry on Chopped anyway.
It's the most joy you get out of your life, raising children and watching them grow and flourish and become people and become adults. My daughter's 20, my son's 17, and... There's no greater joy, and it's so funny. I had a friend of mine before, when my wife was pregnant with our daughter, and I said to him, I don't know what to expect, and he goes, well, I can't. He had a child, and he goes, I can't tell you. He goes, what do you mean? Tell me about it. He goes, you can't put it into words. Just wait and see. And he was completely right. It's like, I just, you know, you got to wait and see how it goes. It's just, it's so much fun. And yeah, I was never into sports. I was a line cook, right? I was usually cooking. I didn't have time to go to sporting events. I was cooking when everybody else was having fun. That's what the restaurant business is, right?
Especially and then my American son, sports.
Exactly. And my son is a huge sporty kid. He played baseball as a young child. Now he's going to a school in New Jersey. He wants to play basketball in college, and he's going to
he's playing basketball in college.
He wants to. So he had to leave school here in New York City, and he's in a boarding school in New Jersey because they have a really great basketball program, and he's basically. He's the happiest kid on the planet. He was home this weekend, and I got to see him and hang out, and it was.
So you're playing hoops
such
with him.
Such an amazing kid.
Oh, I don't play hoops with him. He would
just crush you, just dunk on you.
Speaking of pétanque.
But pétanque, you can just reach over and.
Professional.
You know.
I can play pétanque. I can play pétanque.
Taught me how.
Boule.
What's bocce. In Italy, they do it in the lines. Yeah,
the bocce. Bocce.
The French are just like anywhere.
It's a great sport. You can drink and smoke a cigar at the same time.
Spectacular. I mean, it's a real sport. It's a real sport.
It's a real sport.
Where athletics come into
play. From what I can see, Campbell and Kaelin are not going to follow in your footsteps. But what if they said, Dad, I want to open a restaurant. I want to be a chef. What would you say?
I don't think I have that worry. I mean, I don't. There's no way.
You see, they got a front row seat to the misery.
There is no way. I think my kids are so interested in other things.
Good.
And I've always been that way. It's like, you know, it's. I think life for children, it's a buffet. Put it all in front of them and let them see what they gravitate towards. All I care about is if my kids, whatever they do, they're happy. What they're doing it. I don't care what they do, as long as they're happy. That to me is the most important thing. Is you, whatever you do, be happy. If you're doing something you're not happy doing, stop it. Figure out, do something else. That's all there is to it. We're not here that long. I mean, we're on this blue marble, and it's not, you know, we're not here very long at all. We're here for a blip of time. So enjoy it while you're here.
I get it.
And that's why you shouldn't drink cheap wine, too, right? Drink good wine and, you know, eat good food.
I feel like people that don't take advantage of the things that the gifts that they have and the opportunities they have, it's such a shame, because so few of us have those opportunities. And I always used to get so upset when I'm like, if you can afford it, you should do it. You should use it, because not everybody has it. And when you do, you know. Shouldn't let it go to waste.
You know, I take a lot of my cues from you, especially when it comes to fans. You like to throw yourselves, you like to throw yourself out there with the fans. You know, you're not shy. You like to take the pictures, get the hugs, the handshakes. How do you feel about having fans? Which is, I don't know if it's something you ever thought you would have. I never thought I would have that.
I guess I never thought I would have fans. I do feel like that I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if it wasn't for them. I enjoy doing the television stuff. I love the educational part of what we do with Chopped.
Yes.
I love cooking on television. I think it's hilarious. You get to cook a bunch. You don't have to clean up. They do it for you.
Yes.
There's a lot of free food there. It's great. It's
one perspective.
It's fun. But the other thing about being on television is, going back to your first talk about philanthropy, right, and doing things for bettering the world.
Yeah.
We have the ability now, as you know, all of us here can go do an event and auction ourselves off to cook for 20 people in my space or whatever.
Yes.
And it can go for $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, raising money for a charity like, you know, City Harvest, which I'm on the board of. And I work diligently to help with that. It's feeding hungry New Yorkers. And the privilege I have of being in a situation, because I'm on a TV show, to raise that kind of money to help fellow New Yorkers is one of the most gratifying things in the world. And it's just it's wonderful. And you think about something like City Harvest, where there was one thing I got on social media once. It came back to me in spades. It was like just this great moment when somebody said to me, "Wow, I'm so happy that you work with City Harvest. I was down in the dumps once and I needed their help to get back on my feet. And I am back on my feet and I donate to City Harvest now." So that one person who had a shitty something or other, who needed a little bit of a helping hand to come back up, got it from that organization, and I was part of that. And that, I get
most
emotional.
That's the most gratifying.
This is the best thing in the world.
That's the reason why I work with God's Love We Deliver. My dear friend Robert Crossan needed their help, got their help, got better because of it. And I'll get emotional thinking about the fact that he wouldn't be here if it wasn't for them feeding him food.
Yeah.
So he could get over his sickness.
I'm the charity case here, so I just want to say thank you guys for everything you've given me.
No, it's really great.
You know, I didn't grow up knowing about how to give back. A charity wasn't a part of our community. It wasn't a part of our family. And the fact that I get to do it now, that we get to do it, we get a lot of really beautiful stories about how we've helped people even through their illnesses just by watching us. And to me, that is hands down the most rewarding stuff of my career. Cooking food, yes, but honestly, changing people's lives in the way of uplifting them and feeding them, there's nothing like that.
But it comes back to entertainment as well. When we were at Mohegan Sun doing that event, more than one person came up to me and said, "You got us through the pandemic."
Oh, wow.
Like, we were... Yep. They were glued to the television during the pandemic. They had nothing else to do. It's like, oh, it was such a refreshing, because, you know, it's rated G, right?
Yeah.
Nothing bad happens on the Food Network. It's actually the one thing I've heard from parents
as well.
I've
seen a couple of burnt toasts.
Well, that's about it. But, you know, some people tell me, like, you know, when their kids are old enough and they're done with Elmo, which people are very happy about,
Food
Network, having that on, they put Food Network on and they can walk away from the television. No, there's not going to be any crazy stuff going on that their kids are going to be shocked over. It's going to be maybe a cupcake dropping on the floor is the worst thing that happens.
They can watch
and
it together.
The 8-year-old's cool with that. You know what I mean?
As a family, it's a bonding moment. it.
Yep. Wholesome entertainment that feeds the soul and nourishes the... I'm working on it. I'll get there.
Mark Murphy, dear friend, bon vivant, rebel, gypsy, chef, dancer.
I've been working on my Italian, too. I got to come up with some new symptoms.
Multilingual. Thank you for doing everything you do.
Thanks for having me. This is very exciting.
We love you.
Congratulations on the podcast.
I'm very happy
you guys are doing this. It's nice to talk to you guys and talk to your listeners.
Thank you. Maybe you'll come back.
You know what? I'm just around the corner.
Okay.
I'll stop for lunch before I get here.
Please. I'm starving.
Yeah, we're starving hungry. We missed lunch. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Thank you.
Woo! On the Line was recorded in New York City at Dubway Studios. Thanks, Al. Our studio engineer and editor is Mark Frangiolo.
Our theme song is an original composition generously donated and played by Chef John DeLucci.
Our producer is Cindy Augustine, and our co-producer and publicist is Jesse Gerstein.
That's all, folks. Thanks for listening.